I want you to just try to picture the year 1924 for a second. You are standing outside this massive industrial facility in New Jersey.
Right, run by Standard Oil.
Exactly, Standard Oil. And inside, these workers are manufacturing this brand new, supposedly miracle additive for automobile fuel, tetraethyl lead.
The famous miracle additive.
Yeah, but there's this absolutely terrifying problem happening on the floor. The workers are literally losing their minds.
Oh, yeah, it was brutal.
They're having these severe hallucinations, you know, staggering around, swatting at invisible insects. I mean, they actually called the facility the House of Butterflies because of it.
Which is just a chilling detail.
It really is. And within weeks, several of these workers die. And they die violently. So the danger of adding lead to gasoline is immediately, like, undeniably obvious. The public is outraged. City health commissioners ban it. The data is clear. The bodies are literally being counted. And the harm is fully recognized.
Fully recognized. And yet tetraethyl lead remains the standard global fuel additive for the next 50 years.
50 years.
Yeah, half a century. It just goes on to lower the IQ of an entire generation and poison the global environment before anyone finally phases it out.
And that 50-year delay right there, that is the central obsession of today's deep dive. I want to pose a question to you, the listener. Like, really think about this. Why do we, as a society, keep sustaining these systems that we absolutely know are toxic?
It's the big question, isn't it?
It is, because think about it. We have the climate models predicting disaster. We have, you know, the economic spreadsheet showing this massive, staggering inequality. We have public health data showing us exactly what makes us sick.
The diagnosis is just sitting right there on the table, loud and clear.
Right. But the gears of the status quo just keep grinding along, essentially unchanged. And I gotta say, it is a maddening phenomenon to witness.
Oh, it's incredibly frustrating.
Oh.
Especially because, well, our default cultural instinct is to assume that knowing about a problem is basically the same thing as solving it.
Oh, totally. We think awareness equals action.
Exactly. We think, you know, once the scientists publish the paper or once the investigative journalist writes that big expose, the system will just naturally correct itself. But there's actually a profound structural architecture to why harmful systems persist long after their destructive nature is exposed.
And to map out that architecture, we are diving into a really brilliant, comprehensive 2026 paper today. It's by an independent scholar and physician named Bechara Siley.
Yeah, it's a fantastic piece of work.
It's titled The Politics of Civilizational Healing, Power, Incumbency, and Transformational Capacity. And, I mean, this work provides just an incredibly rigorous toolkit for understanding what Siley calls the recognition-transformation gap.
Right. And that gap, it's basically the massive sprawling chasm between acknowledging that a system is producing catastrophic injury and actually possessing the capacity to legitimately, safely, and durably dismantle it.
So if you are listening to this right now and you're trying to figure out, say, why your corporate HR department's diversity initiatives feel completely hollow.
Or wondering why international climate treaties always seem to magically miss their targets.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe you're just staring down the barrel of artificial intelligence and wondering who is actually driving the bus here. This framework is going to completely rewire your perspective. It moves us away from those vague complaints about, quote unquote, the system, and offers a really concrete diagnostic tool for understanding your own agency.
And so Healy starts by drawing this really sharp, fundamental distinction between two types of societal failure. He separates what he calls epistemic incapacity from transformational incapacity. And honestly, understanding the difference between these two is pretty much the prerequisite for any kind of meaningful social action.
Okay, let's unpack this. If I'm looking at a society that is just failing to protect its citizens, how do I know if I'm dealing with an epistemic failure versus a transformational one? What's the difference?
Well, epistemic incapacity is essentially a failure of societal perception.
Perception, okay.
Yeah, it occurs when a civilization literally lacks the ability to see, measure, or validate a harm. The injury is actively occurring. You know, people are definitely suffering. But it simply does not register on the institutional dashboard.
Oh, wow. Okay. I can imagine a few reasons for that. Like a government or a corporation might just be actively shredding the documents and hiding the data, right?
Active suppression is definitely one cause, sure. But it's often much more systemic than just a malicious cover-up.
How so?
Well, frequently, the voices of the people who are actually experiencing the harm are just marginalized. Our institutions don't consider them to be credible knowers.
Right.
So, like, if a low-income community complains about strange odors coming from a nearby chemical plant, and they're having subsequent respiratory issues, but they don't have a massive peer-reviewed epidemiological study to back it up.
The state just dismisses them.
Exactly. The state often treats that knowledge as purely anecdotal and just ignores it entirely.
Or I guess another reason could just be the sheer technical complexity of the issue, right? Like, it outpaces our scientific tools.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, think about the early days of microplastics. We were just filling the oceans with them for decades before our diagnostic technology even advanced enough to realize they were literally infiltrating human bloodstreams.
That is a perfect example. We just couldn't see it yet. Another major driver of epistemic incapacity is what the paper calls administrative simplification.
Administrative simplification. Okay, what does that mean?
Basically, bureaucracies demand that reality fit into these standardized, legible formats. So, say an indigenous community's relationship to a local river involves these really complex ecological, spiritual, and generational variables.
At a deep, multifaceted connection.
Yeah, but a state water management bureaucracy simply cannot process that. They don't have a form for it. So the bureaucracy forces the community to translate their grievance into a simple, standardized property rights claim.
Oh, wow. And in that translation, the actual core of the problem gets lost.
Exactly. The actual nature of the harm is completely erased because it doesn't fit on the official spreadsheet.
That makes so much sense. So epistemic incapacity basically means the society is flying blind.
Yes, exactly.
But the core focus of Sahili's paper, the really meaty stuff, is the second failure mode, transformational incapacity.
Right.
This is the tetraethyl lead example we talked about. The blindness is gone. The data is published in the journals. The X-ray clearly shows the compound fracture. But the society is entirely paralyzed. They are unable to alter the underlying structures causing the injury.
And this is where we run into a really massive conceptual roadblock in how we talk about politics today.
What do you mean?
Well, whenever a known crisis goes unsolved, what is the immediate pundit response on the news?
Oh, they always say, we just lack the political will.
Yes, political will. Sahili argues that this phrase is analytically useless.
Really?
Useless.
Totally. Because it treats political will as some mystical, free-floating energy field that leaders can either just tune into or ignore.
Right, like it's the force from Star Wars or something. And if a policy fails, we just shrug and say, well, the politicians didn't want it enough.
Right, but that assumes the system is perfectly responsive. And the only thing lacking is the internal desire of the leaders.
Which I'm guessing is not the case.
Which is empirically false.
Yeah.
Transformational incapacity leaves very specific, observable traces in the historical record that actually have nothing to do with what politicians desire in their hearts.
What kind of traces?
Well, you see this endless loop of grand investigative commissions, right? Mm. And they yield these beautiful, eloquent reports, but absolutely zero institutional response follows.
Oh, I've seen that so many times.
Or you see sweeping legislative commitments passed with massive fanfare, ribbon-cutting ceremonies, but there are absolutely no fiscal budgets attached to them.
Oh, my personal favorite is the Eternal Pilot Program.
Oh, yes, the pilot program.
Like, a city will openly acknowledge this massive, crushing housing crisis, and their big solution is to fund a hyper-localized, tiny pilot program of, like, six tiny homes.
Yep, and it never scales.
Never scales. It is completely designed to simulate the appearance of action while completely insulating the broader real estate market from any actual structural disruption.
Exactly. Or, you know, you see compensatory measures that essentially just attempt to buy off the victims.
Like giving them a check.
Basically. A government might issue a tax rebate to citizens who are dealing with skyrocketing healthcare costs caused by a polluted environment. And sure, that briefly alleviates the financial pain, but it leaves the actual toxic production loop completely untouched.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are symptoms of a society that possesses the knowledge of its own destruction, but completely lacks the composite capacity to stop it.
Okay, I have to push back on this banality argument a little bit, though, because when we look at issues like fossil fuel emissions or predatory financial lending, we are looking at industries that spend billions of dollars on lobbying, campaign finance, and just blatant regulatory capture.
That's very true.
So isn't it a bit naive to just blame this on transformational incapacity? Like, the failure to act isn't some tragic inability to coordinate, right? It is a highly successful intentional moral failure by people who are getting filthy rich off the injury.
That's a fair point. And the role of active corporate interference is massive. Samley absolutely addresses it later when we get to incumbency. But relying entirely on this narrative of villainous conspiracy blinds us to the everyday structural banality of complex systems.
Okay, how so?
The failure to correct a system is often a failure to compose distributed capacities.
What do you mean by distributed capacities? Like spreading out the power?
No, it's more about how modern civilization is highly fragmented. Think about it. We have isolated the scientific method in academia. We've isolated legal authority in the courts, resource allocation in the markets, and logistical execution in administrative agencies.
Okay, I'm tracking with you.
Each of these domains generates indispensable competence, but they are rigidly siloed. The fatal breakdowns almost always occur at the interfaces between these systems.
Oh, I see. So, like, a team of climate scientists can perfectly model the collapse of an ice shelf. They know exactly what's going to happen, but they don't have the legal authority to rewrite the tax code to price carbon.
Exactly. And the judges who actually do have the legal authority to enforce regulations, well, they don't have the administrative capacity to physically build alternative green infrastructure.
Right. They can't pour concrete.
Right. So a civilization might have an incredibly eloquent, mathematically perfect diagnosis of its own problems.
Mm.
But if it lacks the capacity to coordinate across all those distributed domains, the structural harm just continues.
That really shifts the perspective immensely. If the primary glue holding a toxic system together isn't just the sheer greed of a few executives in a boardroom, but rather this profound difficulty of coordinating a fragmented society, it makes you wonder, what actually makes these destructive systems so incredibly resilient? Because they really refuse to die quietly.
They fight back. And to explain that resilience, the text introduces this concept of regime reproduction capacity, or RRC.
RRC, okay.
Now, we need to be really careful with the word regime here. In political science, a regime is not just a dictatorship. It's simply a stabilized configuration of rules, expectations, infrastructures, and resource flows.
Right. It's just the established way of doing things. So the internal combustion engine transportation system, that is a regime. Global industrialized agriculture, that's a regime.
Exactly. And regime reproduction capacity is the combined ability of all those interconnected elements to consistently reproduce their characteristic outcomes.
Yeah.
And crucially, to absorb external shocks without altering their core mechanisms.
So it's basically the system's immune response to change.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So Housley breaks down the specific blueprints of how this reproduction occurs, and he starts with path dependence and increasing returns.
Path dependence is fascinating. It essentially means that history matters, right? Early choices lock us into trajectories that eventually become just prohibitively expensive to reverse. The classic example is the QWERTY keyboard that we all use every day. It was originally designed back in the 1870s to physically slow typists down so the mechanical typewriter keys wouldn't jam together.
Right. It was a mechanical limitation.
Yeah. And we have infinitely better, much more ergonomic layouts available today. But because every single typing class, every piece of software, and every hardware manufacturer coordinated around QWERTY early on, the cost of switching is just deemed way too high. We're locked in.
Now, take that exact logic and apply it to something like the sprawling, car-centric geometry of North American suburbs.
Oh, man. Yeah.
That represents material and infrastructural lock-in. Essential societal functions, you know, getting to work, buying groceries, picking up your kids, they all rely on long-lived physical systems. Once you pay the highways and you build the zoning laws that separate housing from commercial centers by 10 miles, the entire spatial form of the society is tethered to the automobile.
Right. You can't just undo a highway overnight.
You cannot simply introduce a carbon tax and expect people to just stop driving because they are physically locked into a landscape that requires a car for basic survival.
Which naturally leads to the next mechanism, structural dependence. And I have to say, this is perhaps the most tragic mechanism in the entire paper.
Really is.
We often think of resistance to change as purely ideological, right? Or just profit-driven greed. But what happens when a local government relies entirely on the tax revenue of a highly polluting coal plant just to fund its public elementary schools?
That is structural dependence in its purest, most brutal form. Public revenue, regional credit ratings, and middle-class employment literally become parasitic upon the very activity that is generating the injury.
Wow. Parasitic.
Yeah. In those situations, resistance to environmental reform isn't some shadowy corporate conspiracy. It is a genuine existential fear of transition risk. A local mayor is looking at the reality that shutting down the plant means laying off 1,000 people and completely bankrupting the municipal pension fund.
It essentially creates a hostage situation. The regime says, hey, if you try to dismantle me, you will destroy your own community in the process.
Right. It leverages survival against progress.
But regimes also protect themselves psychologically, don't they? The paper discusses this idea of discursive normalization.
Yeah, discursive normalization, it shapes the very boundaries of our political imagination. It's the power to frame any structural alternative as completely utopian or economically suicidal or simply impossible.
Like, oh, universal healthcare is just a pipe dream.
Exactly. And it also works by highly individualizing responsibility.
Ah, the classic carbon footprint maneuver.
Exactly that. British Petroleum basically popularized the concept of the personal carbon footprint. Why? To shift the discursive focus completely away from systemic industrial fossil fuel extraction and put it squarely onto the individual consumer's choice of, you know, light bulbs and recycling habits.
It's so brilliant in a dark way. It normalizes the regime by making you, the individual, feel uniquely responsible for a massive structural outcome.
It absolutely does.
So a regime has all these incredible layers of armor. It's got physical infrastructure, it's got economic hostage taking and psychological framing. But they also adapt, right? When a regime faces a massive public outcry, it rarely just ignores the protests completely. It morphs. The text calls this symbolic accommodation.
Regimes are masterful at absorbing political heat without changing their thermodynamics. Symbolic accommodation occurs when an incumbent institution, say a big bank or an oil company, adopts the vocabulary of its critics. They might sign on to voluntary, non-binding international codes of conduct, or appoint a high-profile ethics board.
Right. They make these highly visible but completely surface-level concessions.
Exactly.
Like those corporate pledges to be net zero by 2050 that magically include absolutely no intermediate milestones for the next 10 years.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Or a tech company launching this flashy new dashboard for user privacy that is intentionally so convoluted that no one actually uses it. The diagnostic challenge for any citizen is distinguishing between a regime that is genuinely transitioning and one that is just applying camouflage.
And the paper points out that we really have to evaluate the causal structure of the change, right?
Right.
Like adding new regulatory rules on top of an old system, which they call layering, might eventually suffocate the harmful activity, but it also might just be purely decorative. We have to ask, is the actual engine producing the injury being dismantled, or is it just being rebranded?
And to answer that question, to pry open the black box of how these regimes actually sustain themselves, we have to talk about power. And not just as some vague philosophical concept, but as a tangible, auditable mechanism.
This is where Seeley introduces the three-axis power audit. Because in popular culture, we tend to reduce power to just visible coercion.
We do.
We think of power as a police officer with a baton, or a billionaire buying a media company, or a boss holding the threat of termination over an employee.
And that is coercive and material power.
Yeah.
And they are very real, obviously. But they're only a fraction of the landscape. Seeley argues that power actually operates on three distinct axes: modality, direction, and legitimacy. If you want to change a system, you have to audit all three.
Okay, let's dive deep into axis amodality. This basically asks the question, how does the power actually function in the world? We mentioned material power, you know, controlling capital, physical servers, water rights. But then there is institutional power.
Right. Institutional power is the ability to write the formal and informal rules of the game. It is the power of jurisdiction and procedure.
Like controlling the rule book.
Exactly. Think about a city council meeting about a new highway expansion. The residents might show up angry, right? They are protesting. But the council exercises institutional power by setting the agenda, by strictly limiting public comment to 2 minutes per person, and by defining the scope of the debate purely around traffic flow rather than, say, local air quality. Mm-hmm. They control the arena.
Wow. Okay. And what about structural power? How does that differ from institutional?
Structural power is interesting because it does not require you to write the rules or issue commands at all. It arises entirely from your position within an indispensable system.
Give me an example.
Well, a massive financial clearinghouse holds structural power because if it fails, the entire global banking system freezes.
Right. Too big to fail.
Exactly. They don't have to threaten a government. The government will preemptively bail them out simply because of their structural indispensability.
That is wild to think about. And we discussed epistemic power earlier, you know, the ability to define what counts as valid evidence. Discursive power is the ability to shape identity and cultural meaning. But out of all these modalities, the text places the heaviest, most critical emphasis on generative power.
Generative power is the critical variable for social change. It is not the power to stop something. It is the power to compose something new.
The power to build.
Yes. It is the capacity to build new relationships, new physical infrastructures, and new legal frameworks that did not previously exist. It's the ability of a community to pool resources and build an independent cooperative grocery store in a food desert, for example. Or the ability of a government agency to synthesize a massive new public health database.
Okay, so that's modality. Axis B looks at direction. What is the power being used for? Is it reinforcing the current toxic regime? Is it innovating slightly within the regime just to make it more efficient? Or is it genuinely transformative, aiming to dismantle the causal engine of harm?
Which brings us to Axis C legitimacy. By what right is this power being exercised? Is it democratically accountable? Is it transparent? Is it dominating?
Okay, this triggers a major philosophical friction point for me. When we look at this power audit, it is so easy to apply it to the bad guys, right? We audit the fossil fuel company or we audit the authoritarian state. But the text insists this audit is recursive. It applies to challengers too.
It does.
So does that mean a grassroots, highly marginalized movement fighting for a genuinely righteous cause can exercise illegitimate power?
The paper is unequivocal on this point. Yes.
Right.
A movement can have a perfectly transformative direction, say, attempting to dismantle a corrupt policing system, but they can exercise that power through illegitimate modalities.
How would that look?
Well, a vanguard activist group might make these sweeping structural demands on behalf of a neighborhood without ever actually holding a democratic vote within that neighborhood. Or they might reproduce exclusionary patriarchal hierarchies within their own organizing committees.
Man, that is a tough pill to swallow for a lot of reform movements. We tend to grant this automatic blanket moral legitimacy to anyone fighting a toxic incumbent.
We do. But Sahili points out that power is an empirical reality, not an inherent moral property. Transformation requires immense power, and all power, whether it's wielded by a state, a huge corporation, or a decentralized grassroots coalition, it all requires constitutional corrigibility.
Corrigibility, meaning the capacity to be corrected.
Precisely. If a new movement takes power, there must be structured, enforceable mechanisms for the people to contest their actions and correct abuses. You cannot simply rely on the rosy assumption that the challengers will remain perfectly benevolent once they become the new administrators of the system.
Right. History is full of revolutions that just became the new dictatorships. So assuming a community has audited the power landscape, they know what they're up against, how do they actually gather enough generative power to alter the regime? The text explores this really grueling journey from experiencing an injury to possessing actual political agency.
It is a perilous journey. The raw experience of suffering does not automatically translate into political mobilization.
Right.
In many cases, systemic injury just isolates people. Chronic illness, crushing debt, or environmental poisoning, it exhausts the victims. It stigmatizes them. To cross that chasm from passive injury to active agency, a community must achieve four distinct stages of recognition.
The first stage is signal recognition. This is that moment someone realizes that their individual suffering is not just a random anomaly or a personal failure. It is detecting the signal in the noise. It's the realization that, hey, I am not the only one in this neighborhood developing asthma.
Right. Once that pattern is established, you move to the second stage, causal recognition. This requires gathering credible, often scientific evidence linking that pattern to a specific institutional mechanism.
So it's moving from we are all sick to we are all sick because the chemical runoff from this specific facility is contaminating our groundwater.
Exactly. And that requires immense epistemic power, which, as we discussed, marginalized communities often lack. But if they secure the data, they move to normative recognition.
Which is the moral judgment.
Yes. It is the collective moral judgment. It is the societal consensus that this causal relationship is a violation of our fundamental rights or our ecological boundaries, and it is entirely preventable.
Okay, so you have the signal, the data, and the moral high ground. But the final and definitely most difficult stage is political recognition, because a community can possess all of those things and still be entirely shut out of the decision-making process.
Oh, happens all the time.
Political recognition means acquiring formal standing. It means the governing bodies are legally forced to hear your testimony, respond to your demands, and actually include you in the redesign of the system.
Exactly. A regulatory agency might totally agree with the community's causal science regarding a polluted river, but completely deny that community any political standing to dictate the terms of the cleanup.
But let's assume a movement achieves all four types of recognition. They have successfully delegitimized the incumbent regime. They still face the most daunting obstacle in the entire framework, successor, viability.
And this concept completely changes how we think about revolutions and reform. You can critique a toxic system all you want, but if you do not have a functional, ready-to-deploy alternative to replace the essential services that the old regime provided, society will refuse to make the leap.
They just won't jump.
They won't jump. Sanley outlines six dimensions of successor viability that have to be built.
Okay, functionally, the new system must actually deliver the necessary goods, whether that is electricity, housing, or dispute resolution. Technically, it must operate safely at a massive scale. Economically, the pricing model has to actually work without bankrupting the public.
And institutionally, the legal codes and procurement rules have to be completely rewritten to accommodate the new system. Socially, the alternative must be culturally legible and trusted by the populace.
Right. People have to believe in it.
Yes. And finally, politically, you have to maintain a durable coalition of voters and stakeholders to defend the new system against the inevitable backlash from the old regime.
That is an overwhelming checklist for any reform movement, and it leads to this brutal catch-22 that Siheli calls the successor viability paradox.
This is where incumbents really play their cards.
Yeah. The defenders of the status quo will demand absolute empirical proof that the new alternative works flawlessly across all six of those dimensions before they will authorize the funding or the policy changes required to build the alternative in the first place.
It is a brilliantly effective defensive strategy.
It is the systemic equivalent of applying for an entry-level job that requires 10 years of experience. Like, how can a society prove that a fully decentralized renewable energy grid is economically and technically viable at a national scale if the government refuses to fund the infrastructure to build it because it hasn't been proven yet?
Right. And to break that paradox, you cannot rely on sudden magical leaps. You have to engage in staged viability building.
Staged viability building, what does that look like?
You create bounded, heavily subsidized experiments. You use public procurement to guarantee a market for the new technology, which allows it to scale and lower its costs.
Yeah.
And you build massive redundancy into the transition so that if the new system stumbles during deployment, the whole society doesn't just plunge into the dark.
But in the process of building that new successor system, we have to talk about the people whose lives are deeply tethered to the old one. The text places massive emphasis on transition protection, because we tend to talk about systemic change in the aggregate, right? Like, politicians will say, the new economy will produce 100,000 new green jobs.
But aggregate numbers obscure localized devastation. Sakely highlights the asymmetric nature of transition loss.
Asymmetric loss.
Yeah. The benefits of a new, healthier regime are often diffuse and delayed. Cleaner air in a decade benefits everyone slightly. But the losses incurred by dismantling the old regime are immediate, hyper-local, and catastrophic for specific groups.
Right. When a coal mine closes, those workers lose not just their income, they lose their hard-earned pensions, their health care, the tax base that funds their local fire department, and literally their generational community identity.
And if a reform movement ignores that asymmetric loss and treats those workers as acceptable collateral damage for a brighter future, they are sealing their own doom.
How so?
Because transition protection, you know, things like wage insurance, full pension guarantees, linking retraining directly to guaranteed union jobs and community equity and new infrastructure, that is not an act of charity. It is a strict causal mechanism of political feasibility.
If you don't do it, they will fight you.
Exactly. If you do not protect the losers of the transition, they will form a highly motivated, desperate political coalition that will successfully block or reverse your reforms.
Man. So as we navigate protecting the workers, we also run head on into the problem of the executives and the corporations running the incumbent regime. This is the incumbency dilemma. Do we fight them to the death, or do we invite them to build the new world?
Well, the paper argues against treating all incumbents as just a uniform monolith of evil. Sovely maps out four distinct strategic orientations that an incumbent might take when their regime is threatened.
The most recognizable one is defensive reproduction. This is pure hostility. They deny the science, they delay the regulations, litigate every minor rule in court, and throw up endless PR smokescreens.
But you also see adaptive preservation.
Right.
The incumbent accepts some marginal innovation. Maybe they make their supply chain slightly more energy efficient just to look responsible. But they fiercely protect the core mechanisms that produce their massive revenues and the accompanying injury.
Then there is hedge transition. Like a massive automotive company might continue selling millions of highly profitable gas-guzzling SUVs while simultaneously investing a fraction of their capital into electric vehicle research. They're essentially placing bets on both sides of the roulette wheel until the regulatory landscape settles.
Right. And the fourth, and definitely rarest orientation, is transformative conversion. This occurs when an incumbent recognizes the inevitable collapse of the old regime and actively redirects its vast material assets, engineering talent, and organizational logistics toward building a successor system that eliminates the structural harm.
But the million-dollar question is, how does a society actually know when to legally constrain and destroy an incumbent versus when to collaborate with them and allow them to convert? To solve this, the text provides the separation test.
The separation test asks us to look past the corporate logo and analyze their underlying capabilities. Can the incumbent's socially useful capabilities, like their logistical networks, their manufacturing scale, their scientific talent, can all of that be structurally separated from their injury-producing function?
The paper uses a really striking historical comparison here. Look at the tobacco industry versus the chemical companies that destroyed the ozone layer. What is the core indispensable capability of a major tobacco corporation?
Well, it is the agricultural production, marketing, and global distribution of a highly addictive, lethal carcinogen. There is zero separability there.
Right, you can't pivot.
No. You cannot redirect a cigarette manufacturing plant to produce a health-promoting product without entirely destroying the company's revenue model. Because the separability is nil, the only valid societal response is legitimate constraint. You have to force them out of the political arena.
But the chemical manufacturers in the 1980s presented a completely different profile. The companies producing ozone-depleting substances possessed incredible chemical engineering expertise and massive industrial fabrication plants.
And those specific capabilities were highly convertible. Under the threat of strict international bans, those companies could redirect their engineering talent to invent and manufacture alternative refrigerants that did not destroy the ozone layer. They were allowed to participate in the successor regime because their underlying capacity was separable from this specific chemical injury.
Okay, I have to throw a red flag here, though. In the context of modern global capitalism, isn't conversion just a sanitized word for regulatory capture?
It's a huge risk.
Right. If we allow the massive multinational fossil fuel conglomerates to use their capital to build all the wind farms, the carbon capture facilities, and the solar grids, aren't we just handing the keys to the future to the exact same entities that covered up the climate crisis for 40 years? They will just monopolize the new regime?
Your skepticism is entirely warranted, and the text is very clear on this danger. Conversion without rigorous democratic safeguards is nothing but capture. You cannot just hand an incumbent a pile of subsidies and hope they do the right thing.
So what do those safeguards actually look like?
They require incredibly aggressive state capacity. If an incumbent is receiving public support to convert, there must be strict clawback provisions if they miss deployment targets. The state must mandate open interoperability standards so the incumbent cannot enclose the new technology and create a monopoly.
Basically forcing them to play fair.
Yes. There might be requirements for public or worker equity in the new ventures. And crucially, conversion cannot grant amnesty. The incumbent must retain full legal and financial liability for the historical damage they caused. If you do not enforce those constraints, the incumbent will simply write the rules of the successor system to ensure they remain the dominant, unaccountable power.
Okay, let's assume a movement navigates this perfectly. They audit the power, they build a viable successor model, they protect the vulnerable workers, they successfully constrain the tobacco companies and carefully convert the chemical companies, they build a coalition, they march on the Capitol, and they win. The landmark legislation is passed. The treaty is signed by 100 nations. The champagne is popped. We did it.
And this is exactly the moment where most transformational movements suffer catastrophic failure.
Wow. Because passing the law is only crossing the first threshold. The text outlines this thing called the enactment circuit, which requires crossing two distinct thresholds.
Threshold first is legitimate authorization. This is the dramatic climax of the movie. It is winning the Supreme Court case, passing the sweeping environmental act, or ratifying the international treaty. It provides the legal mandate.
But the text warns that formal authority is not the same thing as operational capacity, which brings us to threshold two, operationalization.
Operationalization is the grueling, unglamorous, highly technical work of translating that beautiful legal mandate into functioning institutional practice at a societal scale.
Right. A legislature can pass a law mandating that all public housing must be retrofitted for zero emissions within 5 years. That is authorization. But if the municipal government does not have the budget to buy the heat pumps, the procurement systems to hire the contractors without rampant corruption, or the trained personnel to inspect the wiring, that mandate is less than useless.
And this gap leads to a phenomenon the paper calls isomorphic mimicry.
Isomorphic mimicry.
Yeah, institutions adopt the outward formal appearance of a capable system without possessing any of the actual functionality. They set up the new Department of Environmental Retrofitting, they design a cool logo, they hire a director, they print official letterhead. But underneath the shell, the actual capacity to deliver the service is zero.
So authorization is basically signing up for the marathon. Operationalization is waking up at 5.0 a.m. every day for 6 months to actually run the miles so you don't collapse on race day.
That's a great analogy.
But even if you cross threshold two and the system is running, the paper introduces a third problem, durability.
Transformation is not a permanent state. It is subject to entropy. Implemented change can decay. It can be defunded by the next administration. It can be chipped away by reactionary court rulings. For a transformation to endure, it must actively generate supportive policy feedback.
It has to manufacture its own political defense shield.
Exactly. As the new system operates, it must deliver tangible, material benefits to specific constituencies. Those new beneficiaries, the workers in the new green industries, the communities experiencing lower asthma rates, the entrepreneurs building complementary technologies, they must organize to defend the system.
So the system protects itself by making itself indispensable to people.
Right. The physical infrastructure itself begins to raise the cost of reversal. If a movement simply operationalizes a policy but fails to cultivate a self-sustaining coalition of beneficiaries to guard it, the old incumbents will quietly dismantle the reform the second the public's attention shifts to the next crisis.
Okay, but before we permanently lock in this new, fully operationalized, durable system, the text demands that we confront a really terrifying normative question. What if our quote-unquote cure for the civilization is actually a new disease?
The language of healing a society is historically fraught with immense danger. Throughout history, empires, authoritarian states, and colonial powers have utilized the rhetoric of public health, purity, and curing societal sickness to justify the most horrific atrocities.
Right. Forced assimilation of indigenous populations, eugenics programs, mass coercive confinement. They were all frequently justified by experts claiming they were simply applying a necessary treatment to a diseased body politic.
And because of that dark legacy, Sagley insists that any program of civilizational healing must be subjected to a rigorous four-dimensional healing test. If an intervention fails even one of these dimensions, it cannot be considered legitimate healing.
Okay, dimension one is causal effectiveness. Did the intervention actually alter the structural mechanisms generating the injury, or did it just shift the burden geographically? Like if you clean up a city's air by moving the toxic smelter to a poorer nation, that fails the test.
Exactly. Dimension two focuses on life-grounded outcomes. Did the tangible conditions of human existence genuinely improve? Did maternal mortality decrease? Is the drinking water actually safe? And this cannot just be an aggregate calculation. You cannot claim success if the aggregate GDP went up, but a minority population was sacrificed in the process.
Dimension three is transformational legitimacy. Was the intervention authorized through transparent, contestable means? Was the scientific evidence made public? Were the affected groups given political standing to debate the proportionality of the action?
And finally, dimension four, which is the philosophical anchor of the entire paper, non-domination.
This requires a bit of a deep dive. A policy could be causally effective, it could improve life outcomes, and be legally authorized but still fail this test. How does that happen?
To understand this, we have to look at Republican political theory. In this context, domination is not just someone actively bullying you. You are dominated if another actor possesses the capacity to interfere arbitrarily in your life, regardless of whether they are currently exercising that capacity.
Okay, so it is the difference between living under a benevolent dictator and living in a democracy. The benevolent dictator might give you universal health care and clean streets, sure. But because they have the uncheckable power to revoke those things tomorrow based purely on their own whim, you are fundamentally unfree.
Exactly. If a society attempts to solve a massive logistical crisis by mandating that all citizens rely on an opaque, proprietary artificial intelligence platform owned by a single private monopoly, they might actually solve the logistical crisis. They might pass the first three dimensions. But because that private monopoly now holds unaccountable structural power over the citizens' daily lives, the society has simply traded one form of injury for a new architecture of domination. True transformational healing must distribute contestatory capacity. The public must retain the institutional power to push back, demand transparency, and exit the system if necessary.
I can hear the counterargument forming in the minds of our listeners right now, the emergency objection. If we are staring down the barrel of a runaway climate collapse or a highly lethal global pandemic, do we really have the luxury of perfectly distributed deliberative democracy? If the house is actively burning down, you don't hold a town hall meeting. You let the fire chief kick the door down and take command.
The text definitely engages with this reality. Temporary emergency power is sometimes a necessary reality. But Saley outlines strict guardrails. If emergency power is invoked, it must include explicit legally binding time limits. It requires independent review of the actions taken during the emergency. And it mandates an eventual structured transition back to contestable democratic governance. Emergency suspension of rights cannot be allowed to calcify into the permanent operating system of the society.
Right, it has to end. To prove that this intricate framework actually functions outside of abstract political philosophy, the 2026 text stress tests it against historical and emerging laboratories of systemic change. Let's dig into the evidence, starting with 19th century urban sanitation in Britain.
This case perfectly illustrates the mechanics of the enactment circuit. In the 1830s and 40s, rapid industrial urbanization in London created horrifying public health conditions. Cholera outbreaks were just devastating the population. A reformer named Edwin Chadwick published a famous report in 1842 linking poverty, environmental filth, and disease.
But here's the fascinating twist. Chadwick's causal science was fundamentally wrong.
Yes, he was a massive proponent of the miasma theory. He believed that disease was transmitted by breathing in foul, putrid air. The waterborne germ theory of disease, famously demonstrated by John Snow mapping the Broad Street pump in 1854, had not yet been widely accepted.
So they had a flawed causal recognition, but they still managed to act.
The catalyst was the Great Stink of 1858.
The Great Stink.
Yeah. The River Thames was essentially a boiling open sewer, and the smell was so catastrophic that Parliament had to hang sheets soaked in chloride of lime over their windows just to conduct business. The signal and normative recognition finally penetrated the halls of power.
But the real insight of this case study is that the scientists and the doctors weren't the ones who actually fixed the problem, right?
They provided the diagnosis, which is threshold I authorization. But to cross threshold two and operationalize a cure, society needed entirely new administrative and fiscal capacities. To build Joseph Bazalgette's brilliant, massive, intercepting sewer system beneath London, the government had to create the Metropolitan Board of Works. This new institution had the unprecedented legal authority to cross fragmented municipal property lines.
And more importantly, they needed money. Staggering amounts of money.
Which points to a vital mechanism of transformation, the bond market.
The bond market, really?
Yeah, the text notes that high borrowing costs historically deterred massive public health investments. The ability of the Board of Works to engage in long-term, subsidized municipal borrowing was just as causal in lowering the mortality rate of London as any medical discovery. The capacity to finance infrastructure is the capacity to heal.
Wow. Let's jump to the late 20th century. The Montreal Protocol and the effort to heal the ozone layer. This is widely considered the most successful global environmental treaty in history.
And Saheeli uses the framework to explain exactly why it succeeded. In 1974, scientists Molina and Roland published their paper showing that chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, which were ubiquitous in refrigerators, air conditioners, aerosol cans, were destroying the stratospheric ozone layer. In 1985, the massive ozone hole over Antarctica was confirmed.
So we have clear epistemic capacity, we have causal recognition, but the chemical industry fought back viciously, claiming alternatives were impossible or just too expensive. How did the global community overcome that incumbent resistance?
Through incredibly smart institutional design. The Montreal Protocol utilized a start and strengthen mechanism. They did not attempt to mandate a total immediate global ban on day one, which would have shattered the political coalition. Instead, they established a framework treaty with built-in scientific assessment panels. As the chemistry advanced and alternative refrigerants became viable, the treaty's phase-out schedules automatically tightened.
It was dynamically responsive to new capacity. But what about the developing nations? Asking a rapidly industrializing country in 1990 to completely change its refrigeration infrastructure is a massive economic demand.
This is where Montreal proved the absolute necessity of transition protection. In 1991, they established the Multilateral Fund. Wealthier nations contributed capital to this fund, which was used to actively finance the industrial conversion of developing nations. It paid for the technical assistance and the patent transfers required to retool their factories.
They didn't just tell them to fix it. They provided the generative power to make it possible.
Exactly. Successor viability isn't just something you wait for the free market to invent. It is politically engineered. However, the text also notes a major flaw revealed by the evaluation test. To rapidly replace CFCs, the industry heavily transitioned to hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs.
And HFCs turned out to be incredibly potent greenhouse gases.
Right. They solved the ozone crisis, but created a massive burden transfer to the climate system. Decades later, the global community had to pass the Kigali Amendment to phase down HFCs. It is a stark reminder that even successful transitions can produce unintended structural injuries that require continuous corrigibility.
Our third laboratory is the War on Big Tobacco. This is a masterclass in combating high regime reproduction capacity.
Tobacco possessed an almost invincible trifecta of power. First, immense structural dependence. Governments relied heavily on tobacco tax revenues. Second, a highly addictive material product. And third, they wielded devastating epistemic power.
The 2006 federal court case, U.S. versus Philip Morris, proved this under the RACO Act, right? The Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, usually used for prosecuting the mafia.
Yes. The court proved that the tobacco industry engaged in a decades-long, heavily funded conspiracy to intentionally manufacture scientific doubt regarding the link between smoking and cancer. They weaponized epistemic incapacity.
To combat that, the global community developed the WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, the FCTC. This treaty utilized a portfolio of constraints: advertising bans, taxation, and mandating smoke-free public spaces. It also directly attacked the industry's political power.
Specifically through Article 5.3 of the treaty, which legally requires governments to entirely isolate their public health policymaking from any interference by the tobacco industry. It forces a rigid separation between the regulator and the incumbent. But Saheeli uses the FCTC to highlight the vast gap between authorization and operationalization.
Because signing a treaty doesn't magically make the cigarettes disappear.
Global studies show that the presence of the treaty alone did not dictate success. Success was entirely dependent on the intensity of domestic implementation. Nations that aggressively built the administrative capacity to enforce the advertising bans and massively hiked the taxes saw structural declines in smoking. Nations that ratified the treaty for the photo op but failed to fund the enforcement mechanisms experienced isomorphic mimicry, the illusion of action while the injury continued unabated.
Which brings us to the fourth historical test, what the paper calls the hardest test of the framework: the global transition away from fossil fuels.
The difficulty of this transition lies in the sheer scale of the lock-in. The fossil regime is not just an industry. It is the material foundation of global mobility, agriculture, geopolitics, and heating. The structural dependence is nearly total.
But the successor coalition has gathered immense generative power. The text cites estimates from the International Energy Agency, the IEA, in 2026, showing that global capital investment in clean energy technologies reached $2.2 trillion, vastly outpacing the $1.2 trillion invested in fossil fuels.
The capital is shifting, which is a massive milestone. But the framework warns us that money alone does not equal transformational capacity. The transition is currently slamming into severe institutional and material bottlenecks. You can have the money to build a massive offshore wind farm, but if the permitting bureaucracy takes 10 years to approve it and the supply chain for the critical minerals is monopolized, the capital is useless.
And on top of that, you know, we are seeing intense distributive conflict. If you try to enforce carbon pricing without providing massive, visible transition protection to the working class populations whose energy costs are skyrocketing, you trigger severe political backlash.
The lesson from the energy transition is that green industrial policy must go beyond regulation. It has to physically build new material beneficiaries. It has to create highly visible new infrastructure, secure union jobs in green manufacturing, and lower localized energy costs, thereby generating the supportive policy feedback required to outlast the entrenched fossil incumbents.
Those four cases deal with chemistry, biology, and physical infrastructure. But the final laboratory in Sakely's text looks toward an emerging regime that threatens to alter the very fabric of human cognition and governance. Let's explore the ultimate perspective test, artificial intelligence in 2026.
AI is a unique challenge because we are attempting to govern it while the regime itself is still violently assembling. We are witnessing a terrifying concentration of material and epistemic power. The development of frontier AI models requires staggering amounts of computational power, access to specialized semiconductor fabrication, and vast repositories of proprietary data.
It is an oligopoly. A handful of massive tech conglomerates possess the capital to build these systems, effectively centralizing the capacity to model and understand the world.
But simultaneously, the open-weight model community, where the underlying parameters of the AI are made publicly available for researchers and developers, is driving the cost of inference down. This creates a volatile dynamic where incredible generative power is being distributed to smaller actors, even as the apex infrastructure remains tightly monopolized.
An AI system can be a massive transformational tool. A grassroots environmental justice group could use an AI to rapidly synthesize decades of dense municipal zoning data, translate thousands of pages of obscure regulations, and model alternative transit systems in a matter of days, something that previously would have required a multi-million dollar consulting firm.
That is the promise of epistemic augmentation. AI can vastly expand our capacity to process complexity. But the text establishes a rigid governing principle to prevent this tool from becoming an engine of domination. Epistemic augmentation must never be allowed to cross the line into political substitution.
That is the critical boundary. What does political substitution look like in practice?
It occurs when an automated system acquires the sovereign authority to adjudicate human rights, allocate essential social resources, or authorize state coercion without meaningful democratic contestation. If an AI system dictates who receives bail, who gets approved for a mortgage, or how a city's healthcare resources are triaged, and the logic of that system is proprietary and unreviewable, the society has surrendered its political agency to a machine.
But the tech companies always offer the same reassurance. They say, oh, don't worry, the AI doesn't make the final choice. We have a human in the loop. A human reviews the output before the decision is finalized.
Sam Halsey dissects the human in the loop defense and exposes it as a dangerous illusion. A human reviewer who nominally sits at a desk clicking approve on an AI's output is functionally useless if they do not possess the structural capacity to dissent. If that bureaucrat is processing 500 claims a day, lacks access to the AI's training data to understand how it reached its conclusion, and faces disciplinary action for slowing down the workflow, they will inevitably defer to the machine.
They become a biological rubber stamp for the algorithm?
True democratic control over AI requires the capacity to exit the system. If a society cannot function without a specific proprietary algorithm, it is dominated by the owner of that algorithm.
To prevent that domination, the text references a July 2026 preliminary UN report calling for the creation of an epistemic commons. This is the idea that the underlying infrastructure of human knowledge cannot be completely enclosed by private capital.
But an epistemic commons requires massive, deliberate construction. It is not just throwing raw data onto a public server. It requires highly governed public interest datasets. It requires strict adherence to frameworks like the CARE principles.
The CARE principles are vital here. They stand for a collective benefit, authority to control, responsibility, and ethics. It is a framework for indigenous data governance, ensuring that marginalized communities retain sovereignty over the data extracted from their populations and their lands, preventing AI from becoming an engine of digital colonialism.
Integrating those principles, along with establishing open interoperability standards and, crucially, investing massive amounts of public capital into independent, state-owned computational infrastructure, is the only way to balance the power. If we do not build public compute capacity, all of our grand international AI safety frameworks are just authorization without operationalization. They are fragile paper shields attempting to stop a highly concentrated material machine.
We have covered immense ground today. We started by looking at that maddening gap between having the diagnosis of a broken society and actually possessing the capacity to fix it. We unpacked how harmful regimes insulate themselves through physical lock-in, structural dependence, and discursive manipulation.
We fundamentally redefined power, expanding our view beyond mere coercion to recognize the critical necessity of generative power, the ability to compose viable working alternatives to the status quo.
We traced the perilous path a community must walk from suffering an injury to acquiring political agency. We discussed the brutal catch-22 of successor viability and the absolute necessity of transition protection to ensure the working class isn't crushed by reform. We debated the razor-thin line between safely converting an incumbent and being captured by them.
We saw how passing the law is only the first threshold, and the true test is the grueling administrative work of operationalization and building durable coalitions to protect the new system from decay.
And we grounded all of this theory in the uncompromising test of non-domination. A transition is not a cure if it simply shifts us from the tyranny of a polluting monopoly to the opaque dominance of an algorithmic one.
Ultimately, the most profound insight of Sikkey's paper is that civilizational healing is not an event. It is not something delivered by a singular, heroic actor, not a visionary scientist, not a charismatic politician, and certainly not a miraculous technology. Healing is a distributed, constitutionally constrained public capacity that must be continuously exercised.
I want to leave you, the listener, with a final, slightly provocative thought drawn from the conclusion of the source material. The ultimate goal of all this political and structural effort is not to achieve a permanently, perfectly healthy utopian society. That is a dangerous fantasy that usually leads to authoritarianism. A society is a complex, living organism. It will inevitably develop new blind spots, new injuries, and new toxic regimes. The true goal is corrigibility. It is the capacity to recognize the error and possess the power to correct it. So look at the systems you interact with every day, your local government, your workplace, your digital platforms. Are you just expending your energy trying to elect slightly better managers to run a fundamentally broken machine? Or are you actively working to build the distributed, generative capacity required to completely redesign the machine when it inevitably fails? Because until we distribute the power to build the cure, all the brilliant diagnoses in the world will not save us. Thank you for exploring this framework with us on the Deep Dive. Until next time.